Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and progressive action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman.
What we're witnessing today is a very cynical exploitation of children who can be as young as 10 or 11 or 12 and who are abducted. They are not prepared for this. They are pressed into warfare, often with barely any training, and they're simply being sort of sacrificed in a very cynical way by the adults.
In 1993, the United Nations General Assembly asked Graça Machel, the wife of former South African President Nelson Mandela, to conduct a study on the use of children in armed conflicts around the globe. What Machel found shocked her deeply, and her principal recommendation won immediate endorsement from the General Assembly. Machel recommended the creation of a new post under the Secretary General, charged with addressing the use of children in war. The post was filled by Mr. Olara Otunnu, a former representative to the UN from Uganda, who worked with Machel to prepare her initial report in 1993. Today on Bruderhof Radio, Pete Momsen and I will speak with Olara Otunnu about the ongoing effort to end the involvement of children in modern conflict. According to the latest figures, 2 million children have died in the last decade as a result of war, and many times that number were maimed, orphaned, or suffered psychological trauma. At the same time, more and more children are being used as soldiers in countries where long-standing regional conflicts have depleted the available manpower. But despite what he calls an uphill battle, Otunnu has worked tirelessly to establish a critical legal and moral framework to protect the rights of children. He recently celebrated a landmark victory, raising the minimum age for recruitment into the armed forces from 15 to 18 years. Otunnu now hopes to amend the 1989 Convention on the Rights of the Child to include 3 new categories of war crimes against children, which will be prosecutable before a new international criminal court. Still, Otunnu admits that what the UN mandates and what actually takes place are 2 very different things.
We are witnessing worldwide a very widespread practice of the abuse of children in situations of conflict. Children who are being killed and maimed, children who are being left as orphans, children who are being displaced, removed from their homes because of conflict, children who are left suffering major psychological trauma, children who are losing out on schooling and their health, and of course, children who are being exploited as child soldiers. In the world today, we have more than 300,000 young persons below the age of 18 who are being used as child soldiers in perhaps some 30 countries or so across the globe.
In what capacity do you serve for the UN? What is your goal or your mission as the special representative? What are you charged with by the UN or by the Security Council?
My role is to serve as advocate on behalf of these children who are being brutalized in situations of conflict. So, one, I try to highlight their fate, to increase public and official awareness about the problem and to try to mobilize for action on the issue. Secondly, I try very much to highlight the role of standards, of norms, international humanitarian and human rights standards, but also traditional local values that have provided for the protection of children and women in situations of conflict. And above all, to push for the application of these standards on the ground, not just lip service to them, but their application on the ground. And thirdly, I travel to situations of conflict. I've been to Sri Lanka, Sierra Leone, Colombia, Sudan, Burundi, Kosovo, and so on. And in these countries, I make direct contact with the parties in conflict. It may be an insurgency group, it may be the state itself, and I seek from them commitments, very concrete commitments for the protection of children. They would commit not to use landmines, for example. not to recruit children into their ranks, not to attack schools and hospitals, not to have to interfere with access for relief supplies to children, to stop fighting for a certain period of time, have a humanitarian ceasefire to allow for relief to be delivered, maybe for the evacuation of children or for inoculation to be given to children. So in these situations of conflict, I have sought very specific initiatives to increase the space for the protection of children. And then finally, in the aftermath of war, like in Kosovo today or East Timor or Sierra Leone, even when war has ended, it hasn't really ended for children because of the trauma that they carry with them, because of the homes which have been destroyed, the problem of resettling back into their areas, the problem of reintroducing them to the schooling process, rehabilitating schools and hospitals, problems of orphans who have been left. So even when war has ended, it hasn't really ended for children. So my effort has been to ensure that the actors responsible for post-conflict reconstruction, rebuilding, healing, that they will place the rights and protection and interest of children central to their programs in terms of policy making, resource allocation, priority setting.
Hearing what you said, it strikes me as a very daunting task, all these areas in the world and the tremendous amount of enforcement and traveling and work that you must do and that you need to do. There must be some sort of Or what is it that drives you to do this? Is there anything from your personal experience that sort of, I don't know, gives you the, you know, the ability or the strength to tackle this particular problem?
It's essentially, I think, my attachment and love for children. I grew up in a society where children are especially valued. In some respect, they are put probably too much on a pedestal, a society in which parents and relatives would go to any length to sacrifice for their children, for their, you know, to feed them, to give them opportunities for schooling. In some respect, it's probably a society that went too far in the other direction, where people lived for their children. So I grew up in a society in which children were especially valued. But also, I have, been in situations where I've witnessed firsthand the horrors of war. I come from Africa, a continent which has been especially ravaged by war and where children have suffered terribly. And in the course of my work over the years, even before I assumed this particular responsibility, in my work on peace and security issues, the fate of children have especially struck me. And so, you know, my own personal background, the professional work I have been doing, the magnitude of the problem on the ground have all, in a way, especially drawn me to this issue. But I have to say that in addition to the incredible suffering which one witnesses, the suffering, the pain, the hatred, the terrible passion in situations of conflict, I've also been very struck by examples here and there of extraordinary things being done by ordinary people, often at the local community level, mostly by women and children, in impossible circumstances. And I suppose seeing those examples have kept my hope alive, that in all these situations there are people who represent the redeeming features of their society and the hope for their societies out of the quagmire and suffering of war.
You're listening to Olara Otunnu, UN Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict, on Bruderhof Radio. Are there any particular stories that you could recount to us now of those examples of these extraordinary efforts that you've seen?
I visited Macedonia and Albania April 1999 at the height of the expulsion of Kosovo Albanians, the refugees were streaming into these two neighboring countries. And I was so moved to discover that probably over 60% of the refugees at the time I visited were being taken care of by ordinary host families in Albania and Macedonia. For the most part, very poor families who really had nothing to spare, nothing to share with their guests. But they took in dozens, and 30 and 40 and 12 refugees, usually children and women, spontaneously. It wasn't the government asking them to do this. It wasn't the international community appealing to them to do this. They weren't being paid for this. And shared whatever bread and soup they had with these people. They just opened their hearts and their homes to the refugees. And this was at a time when major governments and the international community was arguing about, you know, how many refugees they can take to this country and that country, you know. I was in Burundi also earlier last year, and as you know, in Burundi there's been a long history of a terrible bloody struggle between two main ethnic groups, the Hutu and the Tutsi. And we've all been told they can never get along, you know. I go to this village called Ruigi in Burundi, and I discover two remarkable women. One is called Maggie. She had been a secretary working at the Catholic Bishop's Secretariat in her community. When the terrible massacres of 1993 took place, she witnessed her own people killing the opposite group and the opposite group massacring her own people. Children were taken from her arms and killed, often by her relatives because they belonged to the wrong ethnic group. And she determined from that experience to become a revolutionary, to build homes and orphanages for children of all ethnic groups, the surviving children of all ethnic groups, which is a very difficult thing to do in a society so polarized by the experience of inter-ethnic massacres. And when I visited her, she now built about three homes of this kind where all child survivors of the massacres, regardless of their ethnic group, are welcomed and are being nurtured. Then she introduced me to a colleague of hers called Beatrice, who is from the opposite ethnic group, if you like, from the Hutu. She herself had been a victim of perhaps the first major pogrom in Burundi, which was in 1972, when so many Hutus were killed. She fled towards Rwanda, got married to another refugee, had eight children. And then with the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, the family fled again, this time to the Congo, to Tingi Tingi refugee camp. And in 1997, that camp is attacked, in again an ethnically inspired attack, and her husband and her eight children are massacred. She then walks back to Burundi, returns to her home country, which she left in 1972. And back in Burundi, runs into Maggie from her own village. And Maggie tells her story of what has happened to the village and the homes she's built for the orphans. And Beatrice decides to return to the village and to join hands with Maggie to take care of these children. So when I met her, I asked her, how is it possible for you, who suffered as a victim of massacres, who's lost your eight children, husband, in an ethnically inspired massacre, how can you be taking care of these children? She looked me straight in the face, a slight smile, and just confidently told me, well, working with Maggie here, taking care of these children, has given back to me the dignity of a mother. I found that extraordinary, and I'm still grappling to understand the meaning of that.
So you really do see both the worst of the conflict and then the best of the people in it?
Absolutely. I see the worst of suffering and incredible adversity and pain, but also I've seen some extraordinary things.
You're listening to Alara Otunu on Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program focusing on progressive thought and activism. We'd like to hear from you if you have questions or comments about today's program. Call us at 1-800-778-8461 or visit us on the internet at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof.
I mean, I guess that kind of leads me into what I wanted to ask you about, and that's the whole question of what happens after a conflict is either resolved or is starting to be resolved and the worst is over, in a place like Rwanda or Kosovo or East Timor, where so many children have seen so much violence and experienced so much. What has worked and what types of forces in spiritual and religious and cultural organizing and work has been helpful in accomplishing the reconciliation that's needed?
Well, in these places, reconciliation is a huge task, you know, because part of what these children will have suffered from is precisely the polarization along ethnic, racial, and other lines. That's what they will have suffered from especially. So seeking to introduce to them tolerance, mutual acceptance, living together, accepting the other people is a very important challenge in the education curriculum, you know, radio, on television. Part of what we have been promoting, the program we call the Voice of Children, program, which is basically to have radio and television programs devoted to the needs and interests of children, to their educational needs, to their entertainment needs, to allow them to tell their own stories, but also to serve as channels through which one can build bridges of reconciliation among children.
So I guess, in a way, actually working for forgiving between people who have seen a lot of hatred between their different groups is part of that. And that's a very difficult topic.
Yes, yes. It is not easy, but is the only way by which we can break the cycle of violence from recurring. If the young people who have been indoctrinated, who have been exposed to violence, and who have been exposed to hate, if we do not heal that from them, they are likely to become the channels for recycling the violence and the hate from one generation to the next. So it's very, very important that we work at reconciliation for children.
This is Bruderhof Radio, and I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. Today, Pete Momsen speaks with Alara Otunu, the United Nations Special Representative for Children in Armed Conflict.
I guess my next question had to do with the whole idea of resuscitating and reviving the traditional norms and taboos against abusing children, because the protection of children is really at the heart of many of the world's religious traditions. And what do you propose? I mean, I've seen in your report that's one of the priorities that you see.
Well, what I've been doing is the following. First of all, drawing attention to the importance of traditional local values, whether they are drawn from the traditional culture and civilization or drawn from spiritual roots or other kinds of religious traditions, but those traditions which have provided for the protection of children, women, vulnerable peoples, including in times of war. In many societies, war was never a free-for-all. There were boundaries drawn around the conduct of warfare. There were do's and don'ts. There were taboos and injunctions. There were things you could do, things you could not do in times of war. And the real tragedy we are watching today, we are witnessing today, is not simply that international norms have not taken root, are not known, and are being ignored in so many situations of conflict. The Geneva Convention, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and other humanitarian human rights norms. But worse, that deeply rooted ethical order that traditionally mediated the conduct of warfare, that provided for the protection of vulnerable peoples, that those traditions have come under radical attack. They're being undermined. In many cases, they have collapsed under the pressure of protracted warfare. So my one task is to draw attention to this pillar of protection so that we can be more conscious that we have two pillars of protection. We have the international norms which have been formally drawn and arrived at, but we've also got local pillars of protection in the local traditions. Secondly, to then work with the communities at the local level to strengthen these traditions which provide for protection. I'm not talking, of course, I mean, in every society there are good and bad traditions. I'm talking about the tradition that specifically provide for protection, that is against the exploitation of children, that's about the nurturing of children, that is about not making children targets, not attacking children, and so to work with local communities to seek to strengthen these traditions.
So the use of children in warfare, you would say, is a fairly modern phenomenon brought about sort of by the breakdown of traditional norms, or are there certain cultures where children were, you know, traditionally involved in warfare?
Well, I mean, chronologically, of course, different societies drew the line at different places as to who is a child and who is now an adult. But I think most societies had rites of passage. You did not, you know, there was a point at which you were deemed to be an adult. And it was not an arbitrary point. And it was only adults who generally participated in warfare. And those who participated in warfare went through very elaborate processes of training and preparing for warfare. What we're witnessing today is a very cynical exploitation of children who can be as young as 10 or 11 or 12 and who are abducted. They are not prepared for this. They are pressed into warfare, often with barely any training, and they're simply being sort of sacrificed in a very cynical way by the adults. So this is a relatively modern phenomenon, the way in which children are being used in this way in warfare. Now, it is true that over the ages, children have been part of fighting groups. But I think in this very systematic and massive and cynical way, it is a relatively new phenomenon. And typically, we see this in what kinds of situations? We see them in situations of civil war, typically, not exclusively, but typically. We see them in situations where war has lasted a long time, protracted wars. In Colombia, it's been 40 years, Angola, 25 years, Afghanistan, 20 years, Sri Lanka, 15 years. These are situations typically where we see children being massively used. And what are the reasons for this? The reasons are partly the longer a war lasts, the more likely that the adults become disillusioned, they get killed, they run away, and so to replenish the ranks of the fighting forces will then reach out to younger and younger persons. But the second and more cynical reason, which is precisely the fact that children are so innocent, they're impressionable. You can mold children into very ruthless, efficient, unquestioning tools of warfare. That is part of the reason why they reach out to get children. You can indoctrinate them so easily. And indeed, some of the worst atrocities we have seen, like in Sierra Leone, were committed by child soldiers, often under the influence of drugs, you see. And then another reason is ideology. Come fight for our ethnic group. Come fight for self-determination. come fight to establish a new society, come fight for our religion. You know, the ideological appeal will often, you know, entice children to join. And then, as I'd say, finally, that there's also an economic social reason that in some societies, when there's a complete social economic breakdown, when the school isn't functioning, the economy is no longer functioning, these fighting groups may look attractive to children because the alternative is worse or non-existent. You know, in the fighting groups, they see a semblance of power in the gun. They may be given a uniform to wear. They may be given food, you see. They're drugged. So the fighting groups in the context of socioeconomic breakdown can become attractive for children, which is the reason why it's so important for us to address these factors. Not every child is abducted to become a child soldier. We must address the economic, social, political, ideological factors which facilitate the exploitation of children in this way.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio. Today we heard from Alara Otunu, the United Nations Special Representative for Children in Armed Conflict. For more information about Otunu's work, check out the United Nations webpage at www.un.org. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman and Ben Wright. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, call us at 1-800-778-8461. To order tapes and transcripts, call that same number. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For further information about the Bruderhof Communities, call us at 1-800-778-8461.